The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology. Welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science only funnier. I'm Pete Ludovitz, and unfortunately my regular co-host is over in England pushing back scientific relations between the United States and the UK by at least 10 years. But today, ladies and gentlemen, I am joined by a very special guest host, someone who's been on the program before, a man who drives so slowly in Atlanta traffic he experiences Lorentz elongation, Professor Andy Zangwill. Andy, welcome back.
Thank you, Pete. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'd like you to know that I'm actually auditioning for Bill's job. As it is, I write all his jokes anyway, and so I might as well take his job full-time.
So, Bill, if you're listening, you're in big trouble, because he's starting out with a bang already, right? He's already starting with the trash talk.
A big bang, you mean.
All right, well, will people get that, Lorentz elongation?
No.
I tell that joke in clubs.
They won't, but
okay.
It's okay.
All right, but the physicists got that, right?
You know, they
Lorentz
did. They
contraction.
Did.
Okay, that's all that matters.
We may have an entire classroom at Georgia Tech listening to this streaming rather than listening to a lecture from their professor. It was 50-50 last night whether he was going to deliver the lecture or just stream the interview. So
and
we'll
this,
see.
Is this your class?
No, it's not. It's one of our colleagues.
Oh, okay.
Who will remain nameless.
Who's blown off his class.
To protect the innocent.
But you know what I find? If ever I cancel class, I've canceled them before because there was like a seminar my graduate students in the class should listen to. They never complain. But they rarely go to the seminar, actually. I show up at the seminar, nobody's there.
Well, that's because of the cookies.
Oh, well, that's true. They probably didn't. It was in physics, actually, last time.
Particularly good cookies.
And you had okay cookies.
We try.
Bad. Hopefully people who aren't familiar with the university environment now realize that without food, nobody goes. I don't care if the guy's got a Nobel Prize.
Graduate students live on Dunkin' Donuts.
Yeah, exactly. The food is the most important thing.
Precisely.
All right, before we get to science in the news, the topic of today's program is hot research from the coldest place on Earth. And our guest is Ignacio Taboada?
Very good.
Okay, very good. Ignacio Taboada, who is from the School of Physics here at the Georgia Institute of Technology. And I wrote his bio down here somewhere, and now I can't find it. But you did your PhD, and was it in astrophysics? Or just physics?
Physics,
because we'll talk about the difference between that in just a minute.
Sure.
Because I'm not even clear on what that is. At the University of Pennsylvania. As did you?
20 years earlier than Ignacio.
Oh, wow. And that would explain the swagger with which you, approach this radio show.
He's exactly like, right.
I'm not sure I want to be in the air with these two guys, but...
we even have common professors.
Indeed we do. And I'm going back in 2 weeks for a retirement party.
So they were still there? Wow.
It's amazing.
Wow. So very long lived. All right. So I don't know. I'm looking at this very complicated description of your astrophysical analysis of subatomic particles coming from the universe. And you use those basically to figure out what the heck's going on out there. Can I say that?
Yes.
Did I demean the lofty goals of your research by trying to put it in the vernacular? And you're involved in, what, a couple big research projects. And do I have these right? Is one of them Ice Cube? Is that the name of one of them?
That's correct.
Okay.
The other is Hawk.
And the other is Hawk. Hawk and Ice Cube. Did you have something for us on Ice Cube, Andy?
Well, yes. I mean, if you Google Ice Cube just to see what comes up, you'll discover that the Neutrino Observatory, where Ignacio works and he'll tell us about, comes up as the fifth citation. The first four refer to the gangster rapper, otherwise known as O'Shea Jackson.
Yeah, but I think he's a fine actor. I've seen some of his films.
But I'm impressed that the Neutrino showed up as number five.
Five, and not 500.
Exactly.
Well, did you Google it with a single word or two words?
I used the spelling that you guys use and the capitalization.
Right. Oh, that's funny.
So I thought
that if you Googled it as a single word, you got it as a first.
Ah,
and that's two separate words.
An experiment for you to try at home.
So
then,
we're saying
you got only the rapper.
Ladies and gentlemen, there are four misspellings of the rapper Ice Cube that appear on the internet before this giant observatory. Okay.
That's right.
All right. Well, so that's the nature of it. And we're going to talk about the specifics of what you do at the South Pole. And you got to believe we're going to ask you what it's like to be down at the South Pole, because that sounds – I mean, do they allow alcohol there? That's what I want to know.
Oh, definitely yes.
Okay. all the movies of the Russians down there, they're like continuously drinking vodka. But I got to tell you, if I were stuck there for weeks or months at a time, what else you got to do, right? I mean, you're inside all the time, right? It's even in the summer, it's not like you go out and play tennis.
Oh, actually, no. You can go out. It can be very pleasant at some times, believe it or not.
What's pleasant? 40 below?
It can be 40 Fahrenheit below, if usually there's not a lot of wind. So if you're well-dressed, it's really nice.
Okay.
One thing I remember with a lot of fondness is a carpenters versus scientists soccer game that we had outside once.
Oh.
And then there's also traditional sporting events like the race around the world. And then there's a 2-mile track, and you go in a circle, and that is typically done a few days after New Year's Eve.
The fact that it's a soccer game rather than say a baseball game is significant here because the group of people involved in this experiment is very international. In fact, the number of people involved in this experiment is enormous. Perhaps you can tell us about
that. Well, we are about 250 people, but the fact that it is a soccer game is to handicap the carpenters. You have to realize that these guys are typically American, are typically, very strong, and then they're playing against the scientists, which are a bunch of wimps. A big chunk of them are from European countries or other countries where soccer is a big thing. So that's the only way that we can have an even game between scientists and carpenters.
But even the Americans, right? Let's think about it. Very few of the guys that are PhDs working down there that were raised in America, if they're younger, we now have soccer teams on high schools and things like that. These were not the guys playing football, right? These were not the really big guys anyway. So even the Americans are probably more familiar with it. Wow. Once again, illustrating the international flavor of science. Right. And that's why it's a good thing. All right. So today's Science in the News stems from an AP story by Morenstein from April 9th that reports that it is not outside the realm of considering some of this geoengineering for President Barack Obama's White House, namely that tinkering with the Earth's climate to chill runaway global warming, a radical idea once dismissed out of hand, is being discussed by the White House as a potential emergency option. And, man, I really hope they keep it as an emergency option. So according to one of Obama's science advisors, John Holgren, who told the Associated Press, the article notes that the concept of using technology to purposely cool the climate is called geoengineering. One option raised by Holdren, and you're going to love this one as physicist, and proposed by a Nobel Prize-winning scientist includes shooting pollution particles into the upper atmosphere to reflect the sun's rays. Holdren said that using such an experimental measure is only being thought of as a last resort. I hope so.
The government is planning to tinker with the climate. These are the same people who brought you the Army Corps of Engineers.
Okay, and what's your complaint about the Army Corps of Engineers?
How long do we have today?
Well, give me the highlights. I'm an engineer.
Okay, we could start with Katrina and the good work they did there.
Are we talking about the levees
and
things like that?
For example, that's right. And then there's the river basins that they've done. I mean, they get some credit for the TVA and electrification of Tennessee. I mean, that was a good thing, I think. But there's a lot of unintended consequences associated with some of the Corps of Engineers work.
So that's the issue. The issue is, I mean, I think that the Army Corps of Engineers actually does a good job because the job they're given to do is you make this happen now, right? That's what they do. They give a very, very short time frame. They have to make it happen. The consideration for what the long-term effects is not in the purview of the Army Corps of Engineers. That's in the purview of the people that use them, which is often, as you pointed out, horribly misguided. And we've said it many times on this program before, one of the single most complicated phenomenon on the planet is the weather system, the environment, the way this works. This is the dumbest. In fact, this was said to me basically by a Republican friend of mine who just wanted to manage the Obama administration. But he's absolutely right. For us to think about this is crazy. And we've had a guest on the show, Thanos Nenis from Earth and Atmospheric Sciences here at Georgia Tech, whose research points out that the particulates in the air cool the planet. So whatever problems we have with global warming, it might actually be worse because of the particulates. It appears to be worse now because we're very good at cleaning up particulates now, right, compared to 30 years ago. In fact, these particulates are so bad, you can actually get natural clouds forming around these particles, right, when the conditions are right. So
I'm more concerned with having Rahm Emanuel decide when it's going to be a sunny day and when it's going to be a cloudy
day. Yeah, I hope we're not going to get to that point. And I think this should certainly be research. We should look at this global effect on climate. But if we are thinking in the next decade to start doing, I think we're nuts. And it sounds like you agree.
Yes. This could be the only time today.
Oh, okay. What do you mean we don't agree? I think
I'm
we agree on a regular
basis.
What is this, point counterpoint?
I know. I'm cloning Bill Hunt.
Don't forget. He just tells inappropriate jokes. I don't know if he necessarily disagrees with
me. I can do that, too.
Okay. All right. Just, Trent.
Should we move on to neutrinos at some point?
Yeah. Did you turn the delay on?
You don't have to ask, yeah.
Okay. He always does. All right. So let's talk about neutrinos. Let me ask the question, though. What's the difference between physics and astrophysics?
Well, I guess physics, it's natural philosophy. You're trying to explain the laws of the universe as a whole.
Oh, so Andy's a philosopher? Is that what I'm...
Well, as a matter of fact,
that's what his PhD means, right?
At the University of Pennsylvania, we had T-shirts made up, which had a big picture of Newton's apple tree and the words "natural philosopher" on the front of them, and this did not help us get dates. I can tell you that.
Well, so I guess the realm of physics is a bit broader than that of astrophysics, because astrophysics is trying to study things that are beyond our planet itself.
Right.
And it's a moving target. It depends on which time period you look at it. You get different subjects of a study. Maybe the planets would have been an astrophysics subject of a study some time ago. Nowadays, more like planetary science.
Right.
So I guess nowadays the big questions in astrophysics are cosmology. How did the universe start?
Mm-hmm.
Also, planets around other stars, mm-hmm. and potentially Earth-like planets and life in other planets, to understand how our universe evolved from its beginning to how it is today.
Right. And if you think about that question, I mean, what does the average person, in your opinion, think about that? I think that's an important question, right? The origin of where this planetary system came from. Could there be other planets, you know, around suns similar to ours? And that's a hard question to answer, right? Because these planets are very, very small, the stars are very, very big, and they're both very, very far away, right? So they work with all sorts of, you know, light and spectral methods to see, you know, do they see the glitch of that planet going around the sun? I mean, is this considered controversial? I mean, do people say, oh, my God, you're working with the origin of the universe, that's a good or bad thing? I don't know.
Well, cosmology is going nowadays to one some people call a golden age. It used to be that cosmology was highly speculative, and if you wanted to measure anything, it would have error bars or uncertainties that were pretty much as big as the number itself we were measuring.
Right.
That has changed dramatically. And at least within some constraints, we understand how the universe has evolved in time pretty well nowadays.
And that's thanks to large arrays of radio telescopes and things like that? Because we can see the radio signature of, say, the Big Bang.
That's right. Well, understanding the radio background from the Big Bang, the cosmic microwave background, has been a big boon for understanding cosmology. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So you guys,
there are other things. It's a multidisciplinary study in which you're using not only radio telescopes, but you're using more regular telescopes as well, and other things.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's get to the topic that's related to your research area, which is, let's start with the interesting particle, neutrinos. What are neutrinos, and why do we care, and how is that different from some sort of Italian panini sandwich? Because that's what it sounds like, doesn't it?
Well, Fermi, in fact, was it Fermi famously said who ordered that?
Oh, really?
No, I think you're mixing the stories.
Oh, no!
So, the neutrino was named by Fermi, and it's called neutrino because it is a neutral particle. That is, it doesn't have electrical charge.
Right, but in Italian, that would be small neutron.
That's right. Neutrino. And that's right. That's exactly the idea. That is a tiny one, and it's neutral. The story you're saying, who ordered that? That was said by a rabbi, and he was talking about a particle, a muon, that was found, and nobody knew where to put that in a theory of particle physics. And he said, who ordered that?
Muon, is that a hadron?
No, that's a lepton. That's like an electron, just like an electron, but
so
heavier.
Is a neutrino a hadron, a lepton, or something different?
A neutrino is a lepton.
Lepton, okay. Mm-hmm. So these tend to be, what, the smaller mass ones, spoken as an engineer who understands nothing about physics?
Neutrinos are
very small.
Neutrino, to first approximation, you can say that they have no mass.
Okay.
Actually, nowadays, we know that they do have mass, but it's so tiny compared to anything else that you can say that it's essentially zero.
Right. So, for all intents and purposes, it looks like a photon. Right? Has almost zero rest mass, but plenty of energy.
And spin.
Right.
So how do we use these things to study the cosmos?
Well, what makes neutrinos so special is that they're a little bit like a ghost. They can go through things without ever stopping. So they can go through a wall or through a planet or from one side of the universe to the other. And that, from the point of view of astrophysics, is really interesting because you can use them to see from on the inside of objects. Mm-hmm. So let's say that the center of the sun produces neutrinos. And that is the fact, because nuclear reactions at the center of the sun are what cause the sun to be warm. Right. So neutrinos are able to escape from the sun and make it all the way to the Earth without stopping at all. So very, very, very once in a while, one of these neutrinos will actually collide with matter. And neutrino detectors try to find those really rare neutrinos that are colliding with matter, and you use them to get a new insight into astrophysical objects.
So, but that's the reason they can go through everything, right? I mean, the average person, they think of, they have no idea what the cross-section of scattering or collision is. They just think, ooh, it's so energetic, it just literally shoots through things. People, I think, forget that most of matter is space. There's a lot of empty space between large hadrons like nuclei and things like that. So this has, it's just so small? Is that why it goes through stuff?
The reason it goes so easily is because it doesn't have electrical charge.
Ah, so it doesn't get attracted to an opposite charge, like an electron.
So if you shoot an electron towards a proton, they're going to be attracted and they're going to, you know, deflect each other and so on. The neutrino doesn't care. The neutrino just goes through because it doesn't have electrical
charge. But if I shoot its bigger, badder cousin, the neutron, through, I get lots of scattering because we use neutron scattering to look at stuff very locally.
Oh, that's because the neutron is a hadron. So the neutron is not a lepton. I don't know how much your audience is going to be following this.
It may be time for a poem.
But
to understand a little bit about the neutrino, this is not a poem that I wrote just for this occasion. This is a poem which was published in 1960 by John Updike, who's a very well-known author who just died. It was published in the New Yorker magazine. It's called Cosmic Gall, which, if with your permission, I will read.
Please do.
Neutrinos, they are very small. They have no charge and have no mass and do not interact at all. The Earth is just a silly ball to them through which they simply pass like dust maids down a drafty hall or photons through a sheet of glass. They snub the most exquisite gas, ignore the most substantial wall, cold shoulder steel and sounding brass, insult the stallion in his stall, and scorning barriers of class, infiltrate you and me. Like tall and painless guillotines, they fall down through our heads into the grass. At night, they enter at Nepal and pierce the lover and his lass. From underneath the bed, you call it wonderful. I call it crass.
Neutrinos are crass. Let me write that down. Okay, let's forget about the audience for a minute. I want to learn something about this. I mean, I'm assuming it's just they're so small, they have such a small cross-section for collision.
That's correct.
So is that true of leptons relative to hadrons? You know, without outlining the entire,
Well, yes. I mean, yes. An important difference between leptons and hadrons is that hadrons interact via strong interactions.
Right.
The strong interactions from one keep.
Okay.
The nucleus together. The nucleus of an atom is protons and neutrons. The protons have electrical charge, the same electrical charge, all of them, so they will tend to repel each other.
Right.
So the nucleus should not exist. It should fall apart.
So
all
leptons,
particles flying away. So the nucleus is held together by this strong interaction. It's called a strong because it is very strong.
It's a strong nuclear force.
It is stronger than the electromagnetic repulsion of the protons.
Okay, so it really is an interaction, right? You have no charge to make it get attracted to an opposite particle. Plus, you don't have this short-range strong nuclear force to make it interact.
Mm-hmm.
See, I learned something. That's good.
So how down there at the South Pole do you know that you've got one? In fact, how do you detect them at all?
Well, the advantage that I just mentioned for detecting neutrinos is that they come from deep inside astrophysical objects, and you can peer in them. The disadvantage, of course, is that they hardly interact with your detector. So the way to circumvent that is to build a gigantic detector, a really, really big detector, to see if you once in a while you're lucky to catch one. And what we're using is extremely clean ice at the South Pole. So imagine that a neutrino comes in from, say, the other side of the planet, and it interacts near the detector, and near is a few miles away, and that interaction produces a charged particle. That charged particle moves through the very transparent ice, and because it is moving so fast, it is moving close to the speed of light, is going to produce a radiation light, bluish light, that is called Cherenkov radiation. So what we do is that we drill holes that are about, 2 feet in diameter and 1.5 miles deep, and we lower a cable, and this cable, we have optical sensors, and we look for this Cherenkov radiation, this light, this bluish light, from this secondary particle produced by the neutrinos. And whenever we see one of these secondary particles, we know we have seen a neutrino. In fact, a telltale sign is that you see that particle traveling upwards from the center of the planet up. And that, because the neutrino is the only particle that we know that can go all the way across the planet.
How many holes are we talking about drilling?
We're talking about 80 holes. And and they're in a three-dimensional grid, and you have a total instrumented volume of 1 cubic kilometer, which is what gives the name to the detector, Ice Cube.
Ah, a cube of ice, Pete.
It's a big cube of ice, is what we're.
And I understand you drill the holes with hot water.
That's right. That's right.
We melt
the water, and we just let the drill go down by gravity, so you get extremely vertical holes.
So you pump warm water toward the end of this drill?
Yep.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
And how deep are these things again?
2.5 kilometers deep.
Okay, so you have literally a derrick drilling 80 of these holes, right? Because you got to have large lengths of pipe, right? I mean, this is like an oil drilling process.
It's hose, not pipe, really.
Oh, okay, hose. So it doesn't need to be stiff because the hot water melts it, right? But, I mean, to drill that hole, do you have like a big crane or something lowering? Or wait, it's flexible hose. You just put them.
You have a reel, a big reel.
Oh, wow.
And you unreel the hose. And
oh, wow.
And
okay,
and you
so
have a big building that you have boiling water. And then you put it in your pumps, and it goes at a high pressure because the water is going to cool down when it goes down
so that's
the hole.
How you know they're vertical, because you're using gravity to drive
this
thing down.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Wow. So then what is the role of this giant kilometer cubed ice cube? I mean, is this basically, I want to think of this right, is this, I mean, I think of this as the backstop on a scattering experiment. Eventually hits this thing and you get a secondary particle effect. But in a sense, it's kind of like the lens for your thing. Is that a correct way to describe it?
I think so.
Okay.
I think so. Because with the lens, you can focus things and you can tell in which direction the light is coming from.
Okay.
In that respect, we can use the different holes also to tell the direction in which this secondary particle is coming from. And that is pretty much the same direction as the neutrino. And that's where the part of the astronomy comes in, because we can point back at the object that is producing these neutrinos.
Ah, so basically you get some conservation of momentum, so the particle you see coming up is where the other particle came from. And what you're saying is they come out of the planet, because many of the neutrinos that you measure don't come down out of the sky. They come through the backside of the planet, through the North Pole, and end up focused in this ice cube. And it just happens to be that, you know, a neutrino, like you mentioned before, you can go through the planet and go through many planets and go through most of the universe and never hit anything.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually, there is a finite probability that in any given piece of space, it'll hit something. It'll hit some nuclei.
It's tiny.
Yeah.
For example, our sun produces neutrinos that have energies that are MeV scale. Okay.
And we got to define that one. Mega electron volts. So a single electron with a potential of millions of volts, right?
That's
right. Think about that. That's a single electron.
Millions and millions.
Right. So you could get a million volts if you just had one electron passing through your wire with that. But in fact, your normal, you know, amp or so, an amp current is 10 to the 19th electron. So that's a lot of energy.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So the sun produces neutrinos that are MeV scale, mega electron volts. And if you put your, you know, pinky finger through the nail, every second you have about 10 billion of neutrinos produced by the sun going through your nail.
Wow.
The nail of your pinky finger.
Does that explain the fungus on my toenails, or they're totally unrelated?
But in this big detector, we'll just ignore that, Pete.
Okay.
In this gigantic detector, in, say, one 24-hour period, how many neutrinos do you detect?
We see about I mean, once the detector is completed, in construction right now, we will see about 300 per
300
day.
A day.
300 per day. That's correct.
And how many do you need to say something interesting scientifically?
Well, these 300 that we see a day are not astrophysical neutrinos. They're actually produced in the upper atmosphere. They're known as atmospheric neutrinos. And what happens is that you have cosmic rays, which are charged particles, protons or heavier nuclei. They collide in the upper atmosphere. And in these collisions, you have showers of particles, many, many different types of particles. And among them are neutrinos. And then these neutrinos can go across the planet. And once in a while, you get lucky and you get a handful of them in your detector. So we have to look through this forest of atmospheric neutrinos and see if we can actually find a hot spot in the sky that tells us there is something extra there that is not coming from these emission from the atmosphere.
Oh, so you even have to filter out this background emission.
Yep.
But think about it. You've got a cubic kilometer. You get 300. How many were going through my fingernail a little while ago? 10 to the eighth?
Well, that example doesn't really work right because the neutrinos that we're looking for in Ice Cube are not the solar neutrinos. We're looking for much higher energy neutrinos.
Right.
We're looking for neutrinos that have a million times more energy than the solar neutrinos.
Okay.
So So solar neutrinos have actually been seen already in detectors in Canada, in Japan, and so on. These very high energy neutrinos that are even more energetic than the ones coming from the sun,
more energetic than 8 mega
from,
electron volts.
That's right.
So they would actually be 8 tera electron volts.
They would be tera electron volts, which is a trillion electron volts.
Wow.
And these would be coming from supermassive black holes at the center of the galaxy.
Oh, okay.
They will be coming from supernova explosions. They will be coming from the remnants of supernova explosions and other catastrophic events in the universe.
And that's the kind of position
we
want
have
to
a
study,
caller.
Right?
That's right. That's right.
Do we? Yeah, we do.
All right, put him on the air.
Yeah, working on it.
We were going to take him in the second half, but I can't believe someone's calling. Yeah, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello. You're on Inside Black Box.
Hello.
Did they hang up on you again, Trent?
I don't know. Maybe.
All right. You want to see if we can get them back in the second half of the show?
Yeah, maybe.
Okay.
I remember they said that they...
Please call back.
Yeah, to respond to you, though, they said that they only had a high school education and they were following you just fine. So.
Oh, wow. Well, that's... I just act as though I have an elementary school education, so that's good. See, I'll ask the questions. Lepton, you know, Hadron. It's all confusing.
Yeah, maybe the phone's curved or something.
All right. So what we should talk about is... Once you do this big experiment and you filter out the solar neutrinos and the neutrinos that happen in the upper atmosphere, and you get these far away neutrinos. Do you call those cosmic neutrinos? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, that's exactly the name.
So the cosmic neutrinos, what sort of things do you look at?
Well, you look at where they're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
That's the very first thing, because that tells you, is it coming from a galaxy that is different from our own? Is it coming from an object inside our own galaxy?
Mm-hmm.
So that is the very first thing you look at. But then you also begin to look at other characteristics. For example, time profile. Is this something that has happened periodically?
Mm-hmm.
And you have, every month you get one and you have some periodicity. Or is it something that is more steady in time? Or is it a one-time thing?
Right.
Because that tells you what different kind of object you're dealing with.
So
for example, a supernova explosion is something going to be transient. And it's going to be a one-off situation.
Okay.
But then a supermassive black hole at the center of a galaxy could be more steady and you have emission all the time.
Right.
So that's another thing you look at. And you also look at how energetic these neutrinos are. We have some way of saying this is relatively low energy or this is relatively high energy. And that also tells you about the mechanisms that produce these neutrinos in these places.
So here's the question. What do you learn from these neutrino experiments that you don't get from looking at it in an optical or radio or infrared telescope? Right?
Oh, you learn
other
a lot.
Stuff?
Yeah, you learn a lot.
Right, because people out there are thinking, okay, they're in this giant ice cube. Why can't I look at this at the Palomar Observatory or Palomar? How do you pronounce that? What's the
Palomar.
Palomar. The Palomar Observatory, one of the ones on Mount Haleakala or something like that. So what's the cool stuff you learn about the universe?
Well, if we learn anything in astronomy, is every time that you use a new method to look at the universe, that you learn something new. So, Galileo began with the telescope, and he didn't know what he was going to find, but he looked at Jupiter and he found four moons going around Jupiter, and the radio, the big break in microwave background, where people doing studies in telecommunication industry, Penzias mm-hmm. and Wilson, they're, you know, they had this pesky noise in their antennas that didn't go away,
oh.
and that turns out to be the relic of the Big Bang.
Mm-hmm.
So very generically, I can say that any new way to look at the universe is going to provide you with more information. In particular, neutrinos, I mean, this is just one of the things they can do, but they can point us to the sources of the cosmic rays.
Mm-hmm.
So cosmic rays, I mentioned them before, are these charged particles that are arriving at our planet from all directions, and even though they were discovered almost 100 years ago by Victor Hess, we still don't know where they're coming from. And
are these the highest energy things that we were able to detect, and we don't know the origin?
The highest energy cosmic rays have energies that are 10 to the 20 electron volts. To put that in a scale, that is the same kinetic energy as a baseball, thrown by a professional player, a professional
proton.
Pitcher. And it's a single proton. Or nuclei of an atom that has the same energy as a baseball. So we're talking about macroscopic energies in a subatomic particle.
I mean, luckily, the cross-section is small, so it's not like it's knocking you on the head like a baseball. Because if it did, it would be horrible, right?
You wouldn't want to be beamed by a proton.
You wouldn't.
Not one of these, that's true.
Wow. but we've always had this background of cosmic radiation.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I thought we knew where that came from. We don't know where that came from?
We have hypotheses, and they sort of fit, but mm-hmm. There's no smoking gun proof that says, yes, we found that they have to be. These have to be the sources. Typically, we say that there are two types of cosmic rays. There are the galactic cosmic rays, which are produced by sources in our own galaxy, and the candidate most people believe are the remnants of supernova explosions. So you have to think that when the star goes boom, there's an envelope, the atmosphere of the star goes out and collides with material around this star, and in that collision, particles are accelerated to really high energies, and these particles that are accelerated turn out to be the cosmic rays.
Oh, okay.
But that only works up to a certain energy, and beyond that energy, probably supernova explosions are not able to accelerate particles, and that's what people have been looking also for extra galactic sources of cosmic rays.
Okay, so there is a source,
and there's a bit more. Yeah. Murky picture. Some people have talked about active black nuclei, which are these supermassive black holes at the center of galaxies. Other people have also talked about gamma ray bursts, mm-hmm. which are these gigantic explosions that can outshine the rest of the universe
mm-hmm.
in the brief momentarily,
right.
That we think are related to supernova explosions, but the details are still unclear somewhat.
Wow.
Cosmic rays can also be accelerated in galaxy clusters, and the cool thing about using neutrinos is that whatever mechanism you use to produce cosmic rays, neutrinos have to be a byproduct. There's no known way to produce cosmic rays in astrophysical objects without producing neutrinos. So if you see a neutrino, because they point back directly at the source, then you have found the sources of the cosmic rays.
So this is a way to track potential sources of cosmic rays.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so I'd like to talk a little bit more about the specifics of some of the stuff you've seen after the break. And then, of course, what's it like doing research at the South Pole after we take a quick break? And when we come back, if you do have a question or a comment for Ignacio about this topic, please give us a call at the studio at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number 404-894-2468. We'll take a quick break and be right back here on Inside the Black Box on WREK Atlanta.
If you're looking for the best banjo pickers, then tune in to the Back Alley Poor Cruise every Sunday night from 9 to 10 p.m. right here on WREK Atlanta. Once again, that's the Back Alley Pork Roost, every Sunday night from 9 to 10 p.m., right here on WREK Atlanta.
Stonehenge, the finest classic rock radio on earth, every Friday from 8 p.m. till midnight. Stonehenge begins with the classic rock album of the week, played in its entirety. Then we kick off the weekend in style with more than 3 hours of the finest rock music in the universe. Stonehenge, classic rock you don't hear on the radio, every Friday from 8 p.m. till midnight on WREK Atlanta.
Susie Orman here with a message from the FDIC. Recently, I got a letter from a woman who took all of her money out of the bank and put it in a shoebox. You know what I told her? Put it back in an FDIC member bank now. If you stay within coverage limits, you can't lose a penny. Go to myfdicinsurance.gov and click on Edie the Estimator to make sure your money is safe and sound. That's Edie at myfdicinsurance.gov. The more you know, the safer your money.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking about hot research from the coldest place on Earth, namely these big neutrino detectors down at the South Pole.
You know, it's not the only way you can detect elementary particles is by building a giant neutrino detector. When I was in high school, we took physics in the 11th grade, and in 12th grade, we were all looking forward to AP physics with a wizened old teacher who'd been there for many years, and he had the temerity to retire. And so they brought in this young fellow from the local teaching college to try to teach a bunch of smart alecky kids who thought they knew physics and AP physics. And we tried to convince him that you could tell the type of elementary particle you had in a box by shaking it and listening, because they all had slightly different tones that they made. You know, a proton would go, wee. You know, and a neutron would go, chuk-chuk-chuk-chuk-chuk-chuk. And
was this experiment successful?
Well, one kid got expelled, it turns out, because you're not supposed to disrespect the professors. But he's currently, he went to Caltech, and now he works at the Medical College of Georgia, so he did okay.
This is the guy that got expelled?
Yes. He had to get a GED because they wouldn't let him back in the high school.
Oh, wow. Well, there's a lesson for our students
there
that are listening. No matter how much contempt you have for the instructor, and trust me, some of us deserve it, just tone
it
down.
Keep it to yourself.
Keep it to yourself.
But back to the Neutrino Observatory, and off air we were just discussing what the cost of this giant project was. And Ignacio, could you just review that for us?
Well, the construction is about a bit under $300 million. And about $250 million are being provided by the National Science Foundation. And $30-40 million are being provided by European collaborators through various means.
And then to maintain it, to fly in the food. Or do you roast penguins?
Well, that's not allowed by
the environmentalists. It's an Antarctic
treaty.
Really?
Antarctic treaty. You know, Antarctica is not owned by anybody.
Right.
And there's actually an international treaty on the use on the allowed use of Antarctica.
And it's mainly scientists down there, right? Very few people.
For the most part.
Yeah, there's the occasional eco-tourist that likes to see stuff.
That's
hopefully
right.
Not roast penguins.
Yes.
Can
well,
you hunt eco-tourists?
The fastest way to get kicked out of the continent is to kick a penguin. Yes.
Okay, so you can give them a dirty look and an insult, but you just can't physically touch them.
That's right. You cannot get close to them. They can get close to you. They're very curious.
Wow.
Can you keep them as pets?
I'm guessing no.
Think so.
No?
Well, any endangered species like that, the manatees in Florida, they can come to you, but you can't touch them unless they come up to you. So.
Do you ever have a penguin fall down one of the holes that you drill?
Well, the South Pole is in the center of the continent, and penguins live on the coast.
They have to eat, dude. They can't order pizza at the South Pole.
So the only thing that is alive at the South Pole is humans and their parasites.
Are you talking about that friend that I was mooched up in high school?
That's right.
Or some kind of skin surface thing?
I don't need to elaborate, I think.
Oh, okay.
You open a cabinet.
Okay.
By the way, where do you live? I guess we're going to get to this.
Yeah, we're going to get to
it. Would you like to return to the science?
Well, no, we can talk about what it's like doing, research at the South Pole. Because what most people know about it is that movie with the dogs, Eight Below. Have you seen that?
Wait, how about Ice Station Zebra?
Okay, well, I hope it's not that exciting.
What about John Carpenter's The Thing?
That's the thing.
That's exciting.
That's a classic, yes.
How about that?
You've never discovered a morph-changing, shape-changing alien down there?
Actually, no.
Okay.
And then there's the part about it's daylight for a while, and then it's darkness
for like a long time.
Yes. So what happens if you're the poor schnook who winds up having to be down there when it's dark?
Well, the official title is Winter Over.
Winter Over.
So at the South Pole, and actually in other stations, at American stations at, in Antarctica, there's people that actually take that as a job. They live over a year in Antarctica. And of course, in winter, that means that they cannot get out because it is just too cold to fly there.
So they volunteer for this job.
And they watch over the stations, basically?
They watch over the stations, and they keep the experiments running and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you have experiments that are electronically monitored that run all year long. Not necessarily you, but a lot of scientists.
Well, IceCube is like that. IceCube is operating all the time, 24-7.
Wow.
And we're actually very proud of our uptime.
And is the uptime almost 100%?
It's like 95%, but that's extremely good.
So basically, you're sitting around waiting for a neutrino of the right type. And this neutrino, Andy was talking about this over the break, with regard to the cost. What is the cost for that one neutrino, this really high...
When
you get him.
Well, depending on the case, mm-hmm. A single neutrino can be a discovery of an astrophysical source. A single one.
Right, right.
So it could be a $300 million neutrino.
Okay.
In principle.
Well, the Defense Department, those toilet seats that they bought some years ago, they were going for, $75,000 a piece. So,
yeah. Well, so as expensive as that sounds, I just came from a bunch of oral presentations by our students doing a giant algae biodiesel plant. Most of these things, the actual cost to make them was of order $300 million. Or more. I mean, these are huge things. They use hectares of ponds to grow algae and things like that. And it was found that none of them were profitable anyway. But what you're saying is maybe that one neutrino that comes, when you trace its momentum vector back and you look at something that you wouldn't expect this from, right? If you see a recent supernova or something, you're like, okay, that's what that is. But it may be a unique, interesting source of cosmic rays that we have no idea that it existed before.
That's very good.
So okay. In other words, Ice Cube is a tremendous bargain. From this point of view,
even
if we don't use it for cocktails later.
All I could say is what we spend on science, and you guys tell me if I'm wrong, because you do more fundamental science. I do more of the applied science. But even stuff I do is fundamental. What we spend on science compared to what we spend on war and other things, I think it's a bargain. I think it is relatively small, and we learn fundamental information.
Please call
your
congressman.
It's really, really long-term investment.
Right, right. You will run this for decades.
You know, 80 years ago, people inventing quantum mechanics, mm-hmm. they didn't have a clue of the possible consequences of quantum mechanics. If asked, my general public would have said, "Oh, this doesn't serve any purpose."
Yeah.
And then, of course, now we have lasers and semiconductors,
yeah.
and also many things that are the product of quantum mechanics. So.
So let's
basic
remind
science
people
is like
of
that.
This.
Basic science is very long-term investment.
Quantum mechanics was a goofy thing, decades and decades ago. Now your cell phone, in fact, everything uses lasers now, is a product of that, a product mm-hmm. of what we learned from that. Even things more recently, like Bose-Einstein condensates, which was predicted by quantum mechanics shortly after it was invented, decades ago. Now we first actually got one of the first ones by Chapman's involved in this in your guys' department, right?
Yes.
And it's, condensing these fluids to this weird state of matter that's kind of like the superfluid transition in helium, but it's actually different. It's very, very bizarre. But there may be information and computing, implications of this down the road, material science implications of this stuff down the road. And I think in a decade or so, we'll get something neat out of that. So you have several decades. First you need a few decades to discover it, and then certainly a few decades to see if anything practical comes from it.
I also think a bit more philosophical is just that there's a natural urge in humanity to ask some questions of, why are we here,
yeah.
and what is the world like, and to explain things.
Right. What is the universe like?
And that is something that, natural philosophy will try to answer.
Right.
500 years from now, these questions about, you know, neutrinos and what they tell us about the origin of the universe are going to be what our contemporary culture will be remembered for, and not what Paris Hilton was wearing, you know, to a cocktail party.
I like to think that's true. Trench, I don't know, is Trench shaking his head? What do you think? They'll remember Paris? No, you're right. They won't, because we remember nothing about popular culture from 1,000 years ago or 2,000 or 3,000 years ago. We remember...
Well, they didn't have a good way to record it then either.
Well, we had the pyramids, right? We learned about geometry, construction techniques. I mean, cement and concrete, they were invented a long, long time ago, and actually for a while we forgot how to do it. So, you know,
Actually, we know about Greek pop culture.
We know about Greek pop culture?
Yeah.
Well, we had their art.
Well, theater. Yeah. Sure. Theater was pop culture.
That's right.
Yeah, but still.
I take it back, Paris. There could be a place for you in the future. Just not on Inside the Black Box.
Should we have her on Inside the Black Box? Do you think she'd take the...
maybe Bill can arrange that while he is in England.
Okay. All right. So is there anything else we want to say about living at the South Pole?
I want to go back to this lonely... These gentlemen, or actually...
They are no gentlemen, trust me.
What's the ratio of men to women scientists down there also?
I would say that it's probably 80% men or 90%
men. But surely the lonely ones are the men. So let's focus on...
Well, that's true, no matter what the ratio is.
Yeah, there are some women that say...
Because they're scientists, people. So
it's typically half support personnel and half scientists. But the gender ratio is equally skewed on both parts of the population.
I'm interested in the mental health screening is where I was going on
yes.
this.
Yes. Has anyone snapped and gone broken arrow?
That's the question. Who has just gone berserk?
There are a couple of stories. I don't really know the details.
No one's listening. Go ahead and tell us.
So I don't really know the details because that was before the first time I went to South Pole. But I know... I've heard this rumor about this guy that went to sail back home and
sail.
Yes,
as
sail.
In sailboat.
Yes, as in a sailboat, but I guess sailing on ice. And he built this sled with sails.
Yeah, they raced those.
And they had to, you know, they had to catch him, you know, a few miles from the station because he was really going there.
Wow.
By the way, does Delta fly to the South Pole? How do you get there? So a graduate student who wishes to work with you. And spend time at the South Pole. How do you get there?
Well, you fly to New Zealand, and there's a small city called Christchurch, and from there you take military planes. Military planes, and it's the New York National Guard planes.
New York?
Yes, State? New York, because they have planes that are equipped with the skis. And
have you been to upstate New York? I think I understand why.
Actually, it could be that they also would have access to the delicatessen that you'd want to lay in for the winter also.
Maybe.
Is that the case?
I don't know how Andy defines everything in terms
of corned beef and marble rye.
Well,
he doesn't have that. He
I was curious about what the typical meal was.
The food is typically really good to keep the spirits high.
Really good?
Yes, typically
well, so,
it's
so
really
good.
So
what do you guys
good.
Eat? I mean,
yeah. Well, anything imaginable.
So you're like the submarine corps, right? The submarine corps in the Navy gets some of the best food because they're in a tin can for 3 months at a time.
I think that's roughly the idea.
Wow.
In the station, there's a lot to do, but even then, it's very constrained. I mean, you have a basketball court, you have ping pong tables, and you have all the imaginable, you know.
Is the basketball just pick up, or do you have some teams to form, and you have a little league play going on?
You know, last time I went was right before they opened that basketball court, so I've never played basketball there.
Ah, okay.
Because there have been three generations now of stations. There's a station that was built in the 1950s, another in the 70s, and one that is just opening up recently. And last time I went, which was 3 years ago, they had pretty much finished the station, and that was among the last things to be open, which is the new basketball court.
I see, because, you know, Pete, scientists are rather competitive, so I can imagine a basketball game and, you know, the guy who might beat you to the data, you can, you know, jam on him, for example.
Right, so, or else, you know, if there aren't enough guys for a team, instead of playing pig or horse shooting, what do they play? Lepton, neutron, hadron?
That's right, exactly.
Wow, that's very strange. All right, so now, but you're married, right?
Yes.
And you actually, you have a young child?
I have a daughter, she's 7, and a son, he's 3.
Right, but the first time you went, what was it, your son?
Oh, no. First time I went, I was married already, but as a grad student, I didn't have kids yet. Okay. Last time I went, my daughter was 4, my son was only a couple weeks old.
Yeah. Okay, and what did your wife think of that?
She was not happy.
And how
at
long
all.
Were you gone total, including travel time?
Each of the times I've been there, it's been about a month and a half.
Ooh. Because I may be going to the Middle East for a week or two, but you know, it's like Dubai. I'm thinking of taking my wife with me one of these trips. I'm guessing nobody brings their spouse to the South Pole.
No, you can't. What gifts can
you bring back with you
from the South Pole?
Yes.
Actually, it's a little store that sells
snow globes. Apparently.
That sells liquor.
who is the proprietor of that store?
That is a not-for-profit store that provides things for you to buy at the South Pole. And it only takes cash, and it's manned by a volunteer from the station. And it opens, 2 or 3 days a week for, a couple hours.
Do they sell those little globes that when you shake them?
Yeah, snow globes.
Snow globes. I haven't seen that.
Driving ice storm globes, whatever you want to call it.
You get clothing. You get T-shirts, essentially, to give to your family because, they want to show off that you have a relative that has been in the South Pole.
My dad went to the geographic South Pole, and all I got was this lousy T-shirt.
Precisely.
Wow.
There are versions of that one, of course.
Wow.
I think the hosts of this show deserve such a T-shirt moving forward, don't you think?
There was one caller that wanted to know about a seasonal affective disorder.
Oh, yeah. So these are the people that, if you don't... Well, if you're in there in the summer, right, seasonal affective disorder. This is the disorder where you feel bad, you have all sorts of physical and psychological manifestations when you don't get enough sunlight, right? Is that the seasonal affective disorder they're talking about? So if you're in there in the summer, which is when you go, right?
That's right.
Then it's light all the time, right? Life is good for people with that.
Yep. Some people find it hard to sleep.
Oh, okay.
But
I guess I don't think I would. I don't think I'd ever sleep.
Not me.
There are these little black masks that probably you can use for this.
But if you're there in the winter, I'm guessing none of those people have seasonal affective disorder.
Well, that's their lives.
That's their lives, right?
Basically.
They don't mind living.
Well, they go through some psychological and physical, very thorough testing before signing up.
This is what we'd like to hear. So do you have to go through that?
Yes. We get a very thorough physical, not psychological, because for summer, it's not a big deal, but very thorough for physical.
Okay, but I would think just the fact that, do they skip the psychological screening on the scientists because they figure they'd all fail?
Well, I've often wondered if the Winterovers have to pass or fail to be allowed to go to the South Pole.
Yes, there you have it. They're the ones that don't interact with people well, just like a neutrino.
I think it's like the Wunderlich test that the National Football League gives to all the people who are drafted.
What is the Wunderlich test?
Oh, this is, because you're investing so much money in these high draft picks, they give them some test, and it's not been published. I think it's like the tests that show up on the Georgia Tech campus that are allegedly given at the University of Georgia.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Spelling cat, being spotted, the C and the T, things
of this
sort.
How much does a three-point basket count for
exactly.
in basketball?
Things
yeah.
of this sort. And so I wonder what this psychological test is really like.
I have no idea what it is.
I mean, you're suited.
It sounds interesting.
It's like the test that you give to see what sort of job you should get. And so you take a big test.
All right.
And it turns out you're suited to spend your career at the South Pole. This is where you belong.
In the darkened winter.
Exactly. And a physics PhD.
With only 40 other people.
That's right.
Wow. I just...
That's right.
I have a hard enough being. Yeah. I have a hard enough time being in this studio with you two just for an hour. Right. I'd snap. I'd kill people.
Can we hear just a little bit about Hawk, which is another experiment you're involved in?
Sure. So Hawk is a gamma ray telescope or gamma ray detector. And... actually, the interest in astrophysics is very similar to that of IceCube. We're trying to study the very same objects that we're trying to use to study with neutrinos. And the idea is what I said. The more ways you study an object, the more you learn about that object. Gamma rays from astrophysical objects of really high energy gamma rays have already been seen.
So gamma rays are the very highest energy photons.
Yes,
so it's like visible light
to your eyes,
except
this
very
really
energetic.
Has no rest mass, unlike neutrinos, which is almost zero.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right.
And so nowadays we have about 70 or 80 known sources of really high energy, really high energy gamma rays. And about 3/4 are in our own galaxy and the rest are outside our galaxy. And we want to use gamma rays to understand what these objects are. And so Hawk is going to be is an experiment that is in the proposal stage. We're asking for money for it to be built. The idea is to build it in Mexico, and it's in a mountain, Pico de Orizaba, and it's 4,000 meters high. And it will use, interestingly, very similar experimental techniques as the neutrino detector. We also want to see secondary particles traveling through water and emitting this bluish light.
You're going to drill holes in Mexico?
No. In this case, we put water tanks and we put a light sensor inside these water tanks and we build a carpet of water tanks that is rather large. It's 150 meters by 150 meters.
It's like an Olympic swimming pool.
Oh, much bigger than
many of them.
Yeah.
I see. By the way, is Hawk an acronym for something?
High Altitude Water Schoenkopf.
H-A-W-C.
Yes, not K.
Right. Okay.
So, but this is a common thing. It's a common thing in both physics and chemistry that you measure things with a secondary effect, right? If you actually measure the light or the particle coming off, that's a primary effect. But much of what we do, as in the case for both these, is you see it interact with something else and then see the light or particles coming off of that something else, and that's how you tell what you've got and where it came from.
Yeah, many people find that confusing. And the good example I can think of is that I'm not really seeing you. I'm seeing the light coming from you.
Right.
So I'm really seeing secondary radiation coming from you.
Because anyone that actually has to experience me directly rarely lives to tell about it. So just ask my wife.
It's scary just in the studio, Pete, let me tell you.
All right, so we've reached, I guess, what time is it? I keep looking at that clock, and it's, why do we have a clock that's streaming?
You got like 5 minutes.
Okay. All right, anything else we want to talk about before we wrap up and try to ascertain what we, in fact, have learned today, if that is at all possible?
Well, I wanted to get on the question, actually, of cute acronyms, because the particle physicists make a living of doing this. See, and the rest of the physics community, I should say, we don't give cute little names to our experiments. We just build an experiment.
That has a very good reason.
Well, maybe that's your problem.
There's a good reason.
That has a very good reason.
Let's hear it.
You see, particle physics, and this is before astroparticle physics, which is what I'm working on, as you noticed, we ask for a lot of money.
Yes.
And when you go to a congressman and you say, oh, I want to build new E27A, you don't get money.
Mm.
It's better to name it Ice Cube,
Amanda,
like
just
a previous
a bad
experiment,
marketer,
or
Andy, that's it. They market better.
Or Shark, or Hawk, or something like that.
Ah, that didn't work so well with Isabel, for example. This was a big particle accelerator, which was halfway built before the money ran out.
Is this the
abandoned.
Texas one,
or for that matter, the Tevatron also, which was abandoned. I mean, some of these very large projects are started, and then the Congress people pull the plug on it. That has happened, as a matter of fact.
Where is the Tevatron? What is
the Tevatron?
That's being turned down.
That's in Fermilab.
The Fermilab.
You're
right.
Talking about the superconducting supercollider that was going to be in Texas.
At Waxahachie. Right.
And was cut out.
But yes. I mean, though, $300 million for this, the Ice Cube, that's still smaller than what we're doing. What was the Large Hadron Collider down in Switzerland cost?
A lot more than that, right. By the way, what is going on with that? Aren't they having some trouble?
They were supposed to be online at the beginning of the year.
And they're not.
I blame you, Andy.
So how do you explain?
Because you're taunting them over the airwaves.
I am not the experimental particle physicist. We have one in the studio with us. What is wrong with the Large Hadron Collider?
I think they have some problem with the magnets. They have these superconducting magnets. So the idea is that you can produce a very large magnetic field
to bend
the direction of particles, and or to focus them. And these magnets can generate really large magnetic fields because they use superconductors.
Right.
They don't use regular conductors.
Right. At low temperatures,
and that means
the conductivity
that you have to cool down goes
essentially to infinity. So you
That's
get
right.
a lot of current through it, a lot of magnetic field.
That's right. And you have to cool down these superconductors with liquid helium.
Right.
And they had a problem with
these. I see what's going on here. The physicist blames the experimental physicist. The experimental physicist blames the engineer who happens to be sitting just on his right.
Things roll downhill.
They do, in fact. So I don't know. I'm going to blame the guy
so
that delivered
the
liquid helium.
So you're blaming the carpenters, right?
Yes, I'm blaming the carpenters, who apparently are bad soccer players. player. That's right. Simple.
That's right. That's right.
All right. So perhaps we should make a feeble attempt at discerning what we have learned today.
The big picture.
The big picture. Okay. So first of all, based on your poem, we've learned that neutrinos are crass.
That's right.
We've also learned that they don't interact. That's why they can go through entire planets, planetary systems, galaxies, big chunks of the universe, because they are leptons. I learned this. They have no charge, so there's no static electricity, electrostatic interaction between oppositely charged particles. Plus, because they're lepton, they don't have this strong nuclear force that holds the nuclei together. And that why when they get near a particle, they don't want to bend toward it, right? It's a poor interaction.
Very good.
And that's, so I learned something. So that was very useful. Also, we learned about very interesting experiments at the South Pole and in Mexico, but particularly at the South Pole, using a giant chunk of ice to get a secondary effect from neutrinos and then learn about fascinating phenomenon out in the universe.
And we learned some sociology about living where it's cold and dark.
Yeah. And that they don't psychologically profile the scientists. When in fact they should. Who was the guy that went Broken Arrow on you and tried to sail off the planet? Was that a support guy? This story you were telling us, was that a support guy or a scientist?
I don't know. All I know is it was a wind rover.
Okay.
You need to find out. Actually, Ignacio has a telephone conference several times a week with his collaborators. It's this big group of people that's out to communicate. So perhaps one of those many people will know. And you can come back on the show and tell us.
Yeah, we'd like to.
Where is this guy today? He's probably running Metro Goldwyn Mayer or something or something like that.
Right, but despite the fact that the cost per, you know, outside the galaxy neutrino giving us fundamental information about new things might be $300 million per neutrino, you can't put a price on that fundamental physical knowledge. As we use as a metaphor, you know, lasers, quantum mechanics, things like that. They now have practical applications. I have little doubt that long after at least Andy and I are gone, you know, Ignacio, he may be around, someone will figure out a practical application. All right. Was that good? Is there anything else you guys want to add?
That's fantastic.
Excellent work, Pete, always.
Okay, and he's just brown-nosing because he wants Bill's job, ladies and gentlemen. We'll probably hear him next week.
Cards and letters, if I should take it permanently.
All right. Well, Ignacio, thank you so much for being in the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
As always, a pleasure. If you do have a comment about this show or any other show or whether or not we should have Andy back on a regular basis, please send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. Next week, our show is entitled Why Johnny Can't Communicate. We'll be talking to Jacqueline Mulholly Snedeker and Christina Bourgeois, who are the writing coordinators from the Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering and Electrical and Computer Engineering schools here at Georgia Tech, about efforts to teach crazy, bizarre scientists, engineers like us, how to communicate to the rest of the world, or as we like to call you people, normal. Please remember, this is a production of the WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology. Please join us next week here on WREK Atlanta for Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.